And Radio Derb is on the air. Our broadcast will be briefer than usual this week, listeners, and somewhat subdued, as I've just said goodbye to a very dear old friend who passed away a few days ago. We just had the memorial service for him. It was, I should say, a very nice service. Special thanks to Peter, the choir master. Still, it was naturally one of those events that leaves one feeling glum. Doubly so, because there were in attendance many mutual acquaintances that I hadn't seen for 20 years or more. That's an unsettling experience all by itself. Time's winged chariot seems to be gaining on me right now, its great wheels rumbling over the cobblestones, and I am uneasily conscious of having done many things I ought not to have done and failed to do things I ought. Still time for improvement, I hope. Well, enough of these gloomy ruminations. Doom vivimus, vivamus. While we live, let's live. And in my case, let's try to find some nuggets of hope, or at least amusement, in the dunghill of a week's news. The week's biggest headlines concerned the Russians in the Ukraine. Or as we're now apparently permitted to say, Ukraine. I don't know when or why we dropped the. It was one of those little onomastic changes that somehow we all agree to yield to from time to time for no discernible reason. Like when they changed Bombay to Mumbai, or Beijing to Peking. Why didn't we change Bangkok to Krung Thep and Cairo to El Kahira? Nobody can tell you. A lot of places used to have a the. Lebanon used to be the Lebanon. Sudan used to be the Sudan. Argentina used to be the Argentine. Ah, where are the snows of yesteryear? Well, most of them seem to have fallen on the United States this past few days, but that's another topic. OK, the Ukraine, or Ukraine. I shall most likely be totally inconsistent in my usage here. The Ukraine is one of those places a commentator comments on at his peril. Anything you say will be offensive to some large group of people. My closest connections to that part of the world are with white Russians, the descendants of people who fled from Russia after Lenin's revolution. My friend who just passed away was, in fact, one such. They feel about the Ukraine the way patriotic young Chinese people feel about Taiwan. They tell you angrily that the Ukraine is part of Russia. Little Russia, Gogol called it. A lot of Ukrainians have a different take. The key word here is Holodomor. That final syllable, the more, is the old Indo-European root syllable you see in the English words morgue, mortality, moribund, etc. We're talking about death. A lot of death. In the early 1930s, when the Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, Stalin's policies caused millions of Ukrainians to starve to death. That was the death by hunger, the Holodomor. Ukrainians haven't forgotten or forgiven. Over and above that, there's the schizophrenic feature that you find in any large issue concerning Russia. Is Russia an Asiatic despotism under imperial rule? Or a European state with a parliament, a constitution, and a free press? The nation is pulled both ways, and always has been. 100 years ago, when Lenin was trying to get his revolutionary forces organised, he was wont to worry aloud that the proletarian state he wished to establish would degenerate into an Asiatchina, an Asian-style bureaucratic empire. As things turned out, his worries were well-founded. Not that Lenin did much to stop the development once he was in power. On the other hand, Russia's magnificent achievements in literature, music, art, mathematics and science are those of a great civilized European people. That's the force pulling in the other direction. The fine American political scientist Bob Wesson wrote a good book about this back in the 1970s, The Russian Dilemma. Ukrainian political psychology doesn't cut exactly like that, but it's hard not to notice that the eastern part is more amenable to authoritarianism, including even Russian authoritarianism, while the western part looks more to Europe in culture and religion. There now, I've already made somebody mad by saying that. The Ukrainian language is in fact mainly spoken in the western part of the country. In the eastern part, people prefer to speak Russian, and many of them identify as Russian. The capital, Kiev, is smack in the middle between east and west, and it's Kiev that's seen the terrible rioting of these past few days. Kiev is a great name in European history, by the way, although our kids don't learn much about it in our schools. It was the main city of a great state, Kievan Rus, back in the Middle Ages. It was Vladimir, a prince of Kiev, who adopted Eastern Christianity for his people 1,000 years ago. The Slavs up to that point had been pagans. The story is Vladimir checked out Islam, Judaism and Roman Christianity, but rejected them all. Islam prohibits the drinking of alcohol, which would never work for Russians. Judaism seemed not to have God's favour, since he had allowed the Jews to lose their country. I forget Vladimir's objection to Roman Christianity, but anyway, he settled for the Eastern style, and the Russians became Christians with an Eastern Orthodox rite. I'm sorry, that's more than you wanted to know, I'm sure. My old friend, the one we've just seen off to the next world, was named Vladimir, so I kind of have that name on the brain right now. Okay, that's all backstory. What's been happening this week in the Ukraine, and what, if anything, should we do? Next segment. One other thing you need to know about the Ukraine, it's corrupt. Way corrupt. On the Corruption Perceptions Index for 2013, put together by the respectable German think tank Transparency International, the Ukraine is tied at 144th out of 175. Tied, that is, with Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Iran, Nigeria, and Papua New Guinea. 144. Russia ranks 127 on that index. The USA is a shiny, clean 19. The president of Ukraine, oh, you see, I told you I was going to be inconsistent. The president of the Ukraine is a Russian from the eastern part who admits he can't speak the Ukrainian language well. This chap's name is Viktor Yanukovych. He's a son of the soil from humble origins, very much like Nikita Khrushchev, who was born 200 miles away, which is right next door on the Russian scale. Also like Khrushchev, Yanukovych has a colourful way of expressing himself that has generated much humour. He's particularly fond of comparing his political opponents to farm animals, unfavourably. The spark that ignited the country's present troubles was the suspension, last November, of a deal between the Ukraine and the EU. That's the European Union. The Ukraine badly needed the deal. The country is basically flat broke, officially from being especially hard hit by the crash of 5 years ago, but actually, of course, in the main, due to those Nigerian levels of corruption, without Nigerian levels of oil to pay for it. There were two problems with the deal, a national one and a personal one. The national one was that the idea of Ukraine drifting westwards towards the EU instead of eastwards towards Mother Russia made Vladimir Putin furious. The personal one was that the EU insisted on Yanukovych releasing Yulia Tymoshenko and letting her leave the country. That's the lady with the interesting plaited hairstyle. Yanukovych's one-time prime minister, but bitter rival. She's currently 3 years into a 7-year jail sentence for corruption. Getting nailed for corruption in the Ukraine is a bit like being arrested for smoking pot at a Bob Marley concert. But there you are. So this deal with the EU was abruptly suspended last November. Putin had basically bought off the government, although that wasn't immediately apparent. He offered them billions in cheap loans and cheap natural gas. Ukrainian patriots and Western-oriented students and commercial people were mad at the suspension, so there were protests. The police overreacted. There were worse protests, followed by worse overreaction, and that's how we got here. There's a little paradox in the case. All over Europe, there's been increasing support for nationalists who are hostile to the EU and its arrogant transnational bureaucracy, most especially to its open borders policies. Nationalists in the Ukraine, on the other hand, look to the EU to help them against Putin and Yanukovych. Nationalists looking to transnationalists for support. But where else can they look? Well, there's Uncle Sam. Our State Department did seem to be trying to get involved earlier this month, with one of John Kerry's people trying to herd cats there. The cats in this case being Ukraine's innumerable opposition political parties, all of which can, as George Orwell said of their pre-World War II French equivalents, be bought over the counter like so many pounds of cheese. The idea was to get a coalition together strong enough to thwart Yanukovych and Putin. We know all about this because the meetings were bugged and transcripts were posted on the internet, probably by Putin's people. It didn't work, and it probably couldn't have. I feel for the Ukrainian protesters. I wish, just as fervently as they do, that they could be a normal European country, instead of a Russian satrapy competing with Nigeria and Iran in the corruption rankings. It's Putin's turf, though. He has all the options, not to mention all the oil and gas. Our choices are very limited. We can make angry faces in the UN, and that's about all. The EU is, of course, a paper tiger, as Kerry's point person said rather coarsely on the bugged conversations. Listeners old enough to remember the 1964 presidential election may recall Barry Goldwater's proposal to, quote, liberate the Ukraine. With all due respect to Senator Goldwater, it wasn't a very realistic US policy then, and it still isn't. 2 weeks ago on Radio Derb, I introduced you to Marcella Sills, principal of Public School 106 in Far Rockaway, New York City. PS 106 is 69% black, 22% Hispanic, and 9% other. Ms. Sills is herself black. The story was, Ms. Sills had been neglecting her duties big time. The kids had no books, no gym or art or music classes, and Ms. Sills wasn't around much. Some days she showed up when school was letting out. Other days she didn't show up at all. All this had been going on for years. The city education department did nothing. Then the New York Post did an expose, and the school's bureaucracy slouched reluctantly into action. Now Ms. Sills is about to be fired. At least the City Department of Education has said it will fire her. Don't be shedding any tears for Ms. Sills, though. She is, of course, a member of the state teachers' lobby, which dishonestly calls itself a union. As I keep telling you, these public sector employee organisations are not unions seeking a fair share of someone's profits. They are lobbies seeking money from the public fisc. The New York State Teachers' Lobby is very powerful and has won extravagant benefits for its members. Ms. Sills has at least 100 sick days accumulated, which she'll get paid for. And the disciplinary procedures necessary to get her off the city's payroll take an average 520 days, during which Ms. Sills will be on full salary, $128,000 a year. Her snout won't be out of the trough for at least 2 years. Compare and contrast the treatment of a white teacher, Frank Borzaleri. I wrote up Frank's case for Tankies magazine in May last year. He too was principal of a New York school, although a Catholic school under the local archdiocese. He'd acquired the necessary master's degrees, two of them, at his own expense. He had a spotless record and was a hard worker, liked by staff and students. Before taking up his career as an educator, Frank had written some articles for American Renaissance, a race realist magazine. They were politically incorrect, but not objectionable in any other way, not abusive or inciting to lawlessness. His writings were, in fact, brought to the attention of the Archdiocese, who reviewed them and declared them free of doctrinal error. Then a vindictive reporter at a local tabloid, a lady who lives in Bronxville, which is a tony and, of course, lily-white suburb of the city, this lady wrote a piece calling Frank a white supremacist. The Archdiocese promptly fired him. Frank legally changed his name and got a job in a different archdiocese. The thought police hunted him down, told the archdiocese who he was, and Frank got fired again. No 100 days sick pay, no 520 days in disciplinary proceedings. Moral of the story: if you're black and a member of one of the public employees' lobbies, you can do pretty much as you please. You might end up fired, but only after years of inquiries, during which you'll be on full pay and not expected to work. If, on the other hand, you're white and not a public employee, you can be hounded out of job after job by Marxist hooligans for saying things like, typical quote from Frank, "diversity's a weakness." Even if no one's ever found fault with your work. This is the pitiful, degraded state we have sunk to under the influence of public sector lobbies and cultural Marxist bullying. Poop floats, gold sinks. Here's another affirmative action twofer, black and female, elevated, like Ms. Sills, way past her level of competence. That's no idle insult. We have evidence this lady shouldn't be where she is. Evidence from her own pen. The lady is named Arenda L. Wright Allen, and she's a judge on the U.S. District Court down in Norfolk, Virginia. In 2006, the voters of Virginia placed an amendment in the state constitution banning homosexual marriage. The issue before Judge Wright Allen was whether this amendment was constitutional. On Thursday, February 13th, she issued her ruling. No, she said, the ban is not constitutional. Quote from her ruling. Our Constitution declares that all men are created equal. Surely this means all of us. End quote. It is, of course, not the Constitution that declares that, but the Declaration of Independence. That a federal district court judge does not know this is staggering. Further, the second sentence is redundant. Of course, all men means all of us. Further yet, it is not clear how the thing declared in the declaration applies to the state licensing of marriages. Why should not states define marriage in any way their citizens wish for the purpose of licensing? If Jefferson's words contain the implication that men have an inalienable right to marry men and women women, how come nobody noticed this these past 237 years? And why do I not have an inalienable right to marry my sister, or my uncle, or my bowling team? We're consenting adults, aren't we? The New York Times, by the way, reported Judge Wright Allen's ignorant words without comment, apparently not noticing the high school level blunder, or perhaps feeling that, since she's black, it would be unkind to point out her error. The Times went on to gush about the judge's, quote, lofty language, giving the following as an example of that lofty language, quote, we have arrived upon another moment in history when we, the people, becomes more inclusive and our freedom more perfect. End quote. To be fair to the judge, that isn't as illiterate as it sounds. In the actual ruling, the phrase, we the people, is in italics, so we can assume it's the phrase, a singular thing, that's the subject of is, not we, which would need a plural. The Times, however, printed it without italics, and so the Times is being illiterate. The sentence is still not so much lofty as vainglorious. Look at me, it shrieks. I'm making history. It's not your business to make history, man. It's your business to leave that to the people in their collective wisdom, restraining them only when they have voted something plainly foolish or wicked. Judge Wright Allen is, of course, an Obama appointee. These are the people set over us to insult and bully us and rip up our collective decisions. These ignorant clowns puffed up with vanity. These are our masters. Heaven help us. North Korea continues to be creepily fascinating. I just recently read a novel about the place. Title, The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson, published a year and a half ago. The author spent 3 years researching the country, and what he couldn't find out, he imagined very convincingly. I commend it to your attention. Well, Monday this week, the United Nations brought out a report on human rights violations in North Korea. And it's just as grisly as Adam Johnson's novel, and as everything else you read about the place. Quote, "These crimes against humanity entail extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions and other sexual violence, persecution on political, religious, racial and gender grounds, the forcible transfer of populations, the enforced disappearance of persons, and the inhumane act of knowingly causing prolonged starvation. The gravity, scale and nature of the violations in the totalitarian state over several decades do not have any parallel in the contemporary world." End quote. I did wince a bit at this, which is in the Los Angeles Times report. They write that the chairman of the UN panel, an Australian judge, quote, said the findings reminded him of the extensive horrors committed by Nazi Germany and other Axis powers, and fully revealed only at the end of World War II. End quote. I certainly don't doubt that Nazi Germany, Japan, and to a much lesser extent Italy, did indeed do horrible things. Why do communist nations get off the hook, though? Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot all committed terrible acts of mass murder. Even minor communist dictators like Ho Chi Minh, Enver Hoxha, and Fidel Castro each murdered many more innocent people than Mussolini did. Couldn't the UN at least give these communists a mention? Especially since it's a communist country we're talking about here. There isn't much we can do about the Norks, given that the regime is under the protection of communist China. They are a threat to us only at a low and manageable level. They produce counterfeit currency, for example, and they have nuclear weapons that they might sell to terrorists for cold cash. We need to keep a sharp eye on them. That aside, all we can do is take them as an object lesson that even in a world awash with wealth and modernity, man can still be wolf to man. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Over in the United Arab Emirates on the Persian Gulf, a committee of clerics, calling itself the General Authority of Islamic Affairs and Endowment, has issued a fatwa against going to live on Mars. There's an organisation called Mars One that hopes to establish a human colony on Mars in 2025. Nah, say the clerics. The place is so inhospitable to life, going there amounts to suicide, which Islam doesn't allow. In scriptural support of the fatwa, the committee quoted the following verse from the Quran. Quote, "Do not kill yourselves or one another. Indeed, Allah is to you ever merciful." End quote. In related news, fundamentalist Muslims in Syria stoned a young woman to death for having a Facebook account. Item. Speaking of Facebook, they just acquired a startup called WhatsApp for $19 billion. That's billion with a B. What does this startup make? Well, they make an app called WhatsApp Messenger, described here as, quote, a proprietary cross-platform instant messaging subscription service for smartphones. Users can send each other images, video and audio media messages, end quote. I've got to admit, I'm so far behind with this stuff, I'm never going to catch up. I just don't get it. Who has so much to say to other people? Isn't 99% of what's transmitted by these apps just empty babble? I have a Facebook account. A friend said I should have, and he set it up for me. I've never used it, though, and now I've lost the password. I suppose it's all harmless enough. It brings to mind Dr. Johnson's many remarks about the vacuity of life. Quote, life must be filled up, and the man who is not capable of intellectual pleasures must content himself with such as his senses can afford. End quote. So, tweet away, everyone. Life must be filled up. Item. Finally, my absolutely last word on the global warming business. I've had a big email bag on this, 40 or 50 emails, three quarters of it contrarian and the others warmist. I have diligently read through them all. I read all non-abusive email, though I don't get time to answer much of it. In spite of the fact that the majority of emails are anti-warmist, the net cumulative effect has been to shift me a tad further over to the warmest side. Other things apart, and I've mentioned some of the other things in previous broadcasts, there's a matter of tone. Contrarianism, when you read through it in bulk, and certainly there are individual exceptions, when you read through it in bulk, it leaves you with a strong whiff of crankiness, conspiracy nuttiness, and monomania. Warmists, on balance, are calmer and more reasonable, and so are the sites that they link to. There's some nuttiness on both sides, of course. Warmists who want contrarians boiled in oil, and vice versa. But I'm speaking of the overall cumulative effect. And I may have done Mark Stein an injustice, assuming from his remarks about his lawsuit that he's a contrarian. A correspondent who asked Mark tells me that his position is the same as mine. Yes, on warming. Yes, on some part being caused by human activity. No, on trillion-dollar schemes to fix it. Good to know. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. To play us out, here's my friend Vladimir's favourite singer, Anna Netrebko, singing one of my favourite songs, Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma. More from Radio Derb next week.